This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear a very insightful interview about the likely consequences for the American people under the coming Trump administration. We will also hear about a landmark victory for human rights and the rule of law in a case we've been following for at least 16 years here on Law and Disorder.
It's a case brought originally by our own Michael Ratner, litigated successfully by CCR attorney, Center for Constitutional Rights attorney, Catherine Gallagher, who hit the Khaki Corporation for $42 million.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Trump and his cabinet nominees are waiting to take the reins of government in a month on January 20th. As Chris Hedges has said on this program, fascist Trump is a symptom of the disease. He's not the disease. The disease is neoliberal capitalism. If Trump was not there, it would be somebody else. Trump won the popular vote by less than his three predecessors, Biden, Obama, and Bush. He lost in 2020 and attempted to stay in power by a coup that failed. But last month, he succeeded in staging a comeback. He'll be more focused, more organized, and more brutal than he was the last time. During his campaign, he took full advantage of the people's disgust with the neoliberal capitalist Democratic Party and Biden and Harris. Her campaign emphasized joy, but put forward no real program to address their situation. 70 million people voted against her. Real wages in America have not risen in 50 years. The minimum wage has stayed the same, $7.50 an hour, for the last 15 years under both the Democrats and the Republicans. Half the country is poor or near poor. Most people don't even have enough money in the bank to survive a crisis. For-profit health care is so arbitrary and cruel that Luigi Mangione has become a popular hero, like Robin Hood, even though he shot someone in the back. Food prices have skyrocketed. Rent is too high. Home purchases are impossible for the average person. So is paying college tuition without going into debt. And the final insult was that Trump, the adjudicated rapist and coup specialist, has been named Man of the Year by Time magazine, which put his photo on the cover and wrote about his ringing the bell, opening the New York Stock Exchange, surrounded by his family. On January 20th, he'll be, in his words, dictator for a day. And then he'll start his program of mass deportation and retribution against people in the government that opposed him. Who are the people he has chosen to support this effort? What might we expect? We speak today with returning guest Patrick Martin, who writes for the World Socialist website. Patrick Martin, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today again. Now, my question to you is this. It's just come up that this bipartisan arrangement, bipartisan bill, really, that the Republicans and Democrats were able to come up with to keep the government open, was now threatened because first you had Elon Musk and then you had Trump saying, no, this is not going to happen. We want to change he wants to change the debt limit and goodness knows everything else. Talk to us about this and what the significance of it is.
Well, I think that the events have to be seen in the context of the whole six-week period since the election, because the radically anti-democratic character of the administration and how it's being formed has become more and more evident. Trump is proceeding on two tracks, which are parallel but not identical. He's testing out and disciplining his own party, and he's also testing out the institutional limitations on his power once he assumes the presidency, what we used to call checks and balances, but which Trump and the fascist right clearly regard as obstacles to be done away with. I mean, if you recall, he began, the first event that took place was the election of a Senate majority leader for the future. The most pro-Trump candidate of the three was defeated. And the candidate backed by Mitch McConnell his deputy, was elected to lead the Republicans in the Senate. So that was initially a limitation as far as Trump was concerned. And then in the first round of the nominations, he selected a whole series of extremely provocative figures. And perhaps the most provocative was shot down, and that was Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. And they just quickly discovered that they had enough Republican defectors in the Senate that he could not be pushed through. And Trump dropped him almost immediately once that became clear. So he's been testing out the Republicans in the Senate and the Republicans in the House, and that's what yesterday was all about. They quickly proved that it is Trump and not the elected leadership of the Republicans in the House that controls the House delegation. Whether Johnson is to become Speaker again in January is now in considerable doubt. It depends entirely on what his arrangement is with Trump. And you've had various suggestions, including while it might sound preposterous as an indication of where we are at politically, the proposal that the House Republicans should select Elon Musk as the next speaker, because speaker by definition does not have to be a member of Congress.
Patrick Martin, Biden called Trump an aspiring dictator and a fascist. When Trump won the election, Biden welcomed him into the White House and pledged his full cooperation. You've written that this is proof of the Democratic Party's cowardice, duplicity, and bankruptcy. Why'd you write that?
Well, look at the timing. The Democrats were increasingly using what one might sarcastically call the F word in the summer. It was while they were initially reluctant, they began to use it more and more, referring to Trump as a fascist. Harris said it, Walz said it, Biden said it. They all used that as an argument against Trump's reelection. Once Trump was the victor in the election, there has been not a single reference by any prominent Democrat. And I might add that the corporate media has stopped asking the question or raising the issue itself. There may be some references to his desire for revenge, for even a certain authoritarianism, but the question that he represents a specific type of politics, accurately described by the term fascist, which has enormous historical resonance, that has been dropped. And I think that is an indication that for all of their professions of alarm, the Democrats are more concerned about the danger of a popular revolt against Trump than they are about anything Trump might himself do. They're more afraid of the people than they are of the right-wing forces that are gathering behind Trump.
You know, I wonder, Patrick, conversely, is there not more that Biden could do now to undermine Trump's obvious intentions to assault the rights of immigrants, the rights of all of us in this country during his administration? He's promised to do as much. Is there nothing Biden could be doing now to try to undermine that to some extent?
Well, I think that there are many things that he could do, but that he's chosen not to do, or at least on the running now when we're barely a month, or we are exactly 1 month from Trump becoming president again. Let's take, for example, the question of pardons. And here I'm not talking about the preemptive pardons of various prominent Democrats and Republicans who might be targeted by Trump. That is an issue. But I recall that I'm old enough to remember when Jimmy Carter commuted or pardoned an entire class of people, which was everyone who had refused the draft during the Vietnam War or who had gone to Canada to avoid being drafted. They were all commuted or pardoned. There was a blanket immunity. Well, there happened to be a million or so, perhaps more, Dreamers. These are people who have registered with the government. They are known. They were brought here as children by their parents. It was not a decision that they made. They did not themselves and could not be found criminally liable. But they have been. They're targeted, and they're now targeted by Trump. Why could not they be pardoned? Why could not everyone who is an undocumented immigrant be pardoned if they haven't committed any felony offenses? In other words, if their only offense is that they are present in the United States without papers, why could not they be commuted or immunized? There's absolutely no reason. I mean, there may be various legal technicalities that would distinguish one class of immigrants from another. But take, for instance, the people who are here under temporary protected status. They didn't commit a crime. They were allowed into the United States by the decision of the U.S. government. And it is widely believed that Trump will revoke that as soon as he comes into office, rendering them more or less after the fact illegal. Why could not a presidential action now change their legal status or at least immunize them from the consequences of an illegal status, which is something different? In addition, there are several million people who currently have temporary protected status. They did not violate any laws when they entered the United States. They were invited in by presidential orders after earthquakes, other natural disasters. They are here legally, but Trump has threatened to revoke that temporary protected status, which would transform them into so-called illegal immigrants. Why can the president not do something now by executive order to protect those people against such a consequence? And really, this applies to all so-called undocumented immigrants. Unless they have been convicted of a felony of a different kind, if their only offense that they have committed is their presence in the United States without papers, something can be done from a legal standpoint to immunize them from the measures that Trump is proposing, the mass roundup and mass expulsion, along with their spouses, their children, in many cases, are U.S. citizens. And as Trump says cynically, we'll keep the families together by kicking them all out together. I think that there are many things that the Democrats could do, that the president could do, but they have shown no interest. The only thing which they appear to be interested in, aside from pardoning his son and perhaps pardoning some individual Democrats, is getting through additional funding for the war in Ukraine, the Israeli war in Gaza, and so on.
Patrick, rather than having a Senate exercise its constitutional power of advice and consent on the appointments that Trump is making to his cabinet, Trump is trying to put the Senate in a recess and make appointments without their advice and consent. What does this mean?
Well, this is an effort by Trump to override in slow motion the constitutional separation of powers. The Constitution was established after the American Revolution by people who had overthrown a king, and they wanted to set up a structure that prevented the return of any form of monarchy or absolute executive power. They made Congress, the legislature, Article I. That was for a reason. The president, who is set up by Article II, is charged with executing the laws passed by Congress. It's clearly Congress which sets policy, and the president which carries it out. Trump is seeking to turn that upside down. Congress is to be subordinated to his will. The judiciary has already been subordinated through his appointments of three Supreme Court justices and their decision last June that the president has absolute immunity from any legal challenge to his actions that he takes as president throughout his term. He can, as one Supreme Court justice put it in dissent, if he orders the leader of the opposition to be taken out and shot, he cannot be held legally liable for that. He cannot be charged with murder. So I think that the purpose of this exercise directed against the Senate, it's a test run for a government that will be really unprecedented in American history, that runs counter to the whole history of American democracy.
Trump is also, Patrick, floated the rather unique idea of setting up what he calls a warrior board. This warrior board would pass on the loyalty of certain military leaders for the purpose of getting rid of them. He's already made it clear he wants to court-martial General Miley. So what do you think about this? How dangerous is this? Do you think this is just some kind of pipe dream of his, or do you think he may be serious about it, and what would it mean if he is?
Well, I think Trump, first of all, should be taken seriously in everything, including his pipe dreams. He learned one thing from 2020, and that was that there was some institutional reluctance in the military, in the upper ranks of the military, to having troops deployed in American streets against the American people. This was not fundamentally because of their loyalty to the Constitution or civilian control of the military. I think it was mainly because of concern on the impact of such a move on the military itself. An army which has been used and instructed to shoot down its own citizens becomes, first of all, obviously it loses popular support, and secondly, it becomes demoralized and less effective in fighting wars overseas. And they were concerned that the consequences of the deployment of the military within the United States would be very negative for the global position of American imperialism. So I thought that was their main concern. Now, his reaction to that was, first of all, after the election, he fired Secretary Mark Esper, who was one of the two, along with Milley, who opposed deploying the troops against the protests over police violence, and replaced him with a special operations colonel without the type of background that most secretaries of defense would be expected to have, but who was accompanied into the Pentagon by a man whose name is now well known, Kash Patel, who was his personal chief of staff, head of his office. And the job of Patel was to make sure that the military did not respond effectively to the January 6th coup attempt. And with Patel standing over his shoulder, Miller and the Army Secretary McCarthy delayed the dispatch of the D.C. National Guard beyond the point where it became clear that the coup had failed, that the local and state police were driving out the mob, and only then was the National Guard allowed to deploy towards the Capitol and finish the job of defending the Congress. But this was a very serious attempt. The House investigation into January 6th never probed the military in any serious way. But Trump certainly knows who was on his side and who was not. And that's one issue that he wants to take up fairly quickly, because the policies that he proposes to carry out, beginning with the war against immigrants, which he's defined as a war, he calls them an invasion, it will involve the use of the military. And therefore, it has to have military officers commanding it who are loyal to the policies and persona of Trump. And so I think it's quite serious.
Patrick, Trump's announced the establishment of what he calls the Department of Governmental Efficiency, and they're supposed to be cutting the budget. I'm afraid that what they're going to do is cut everything except the military budget. Is that your opinion?
Yes. It's notable, for instance, that Elon Musk has intervened now into the budget crisis under conditions, but he waited, and Trump waited, until after the National Defense Authorization Act was passed by Congress and signed into law by Biden. So whatever happens in terms of the budget, they don't yet have the military appropriations bill, but they have the authorization bill, which is more important. That's been passed. That sets policy. They are going to cut spending. They won't cut spending in certain other areas as well. And let me give you the most important one. They will not cut the payment of interest on the national debt, which is now larger than the Pentagon budget. The United States will spend nearly $1 trillion on the military next year, or this year, the fiscal year that began in October, and it will spend more than $1 trillion on interest payments. And now you can guess who gets the lion's share of the interest payments, and they would not be very friendly if Trump was to cut that off. So interest payments will be made, the military will be paid for. What does that leave in terms of the budget? Well, the total U.S. budget is about $6 trillion. If you take out $1 trillion for the military and $1 trillion for interest payments, that leaves you with $4 trillion. Now, the goal of Ramaswamy and Elon Musk is to cut $2 trillion in supposed waste and wasteful government spending. That means 50% of all government spending that isn't the military and interest. Now, you cannot do that without cutting the biggest remaining spending programs, which are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. You can talk all you want about abolishing the Department of Education. That's a drop in the bucket. It's, I think, $80 billion. If you're going to cut $2 trillion, you have to cut substantially from the payments to the elderly. That's the only way to do it. And however they try to dress it up, that's where they're headed.
Well, you've characterized in general, Patrick, Trump's nominees as authoritarian and, or in some cases, fascist. I wanted to ask you about several of them. How, for example, do you evaluate Pete Hegseth, the head of the Department of Defense, or the person he's suggested for the Environmental Protection Agency and the people he wants to see on the National Labor Relations Board? What do you think about them, and what is their mission, if you will, if Trump does succeed in getting these people on board?
Well, some of I think there may be some differences amongst them. Hegseth is clearly a fascistic figure. He has longstanding ties to the ultra-right. He has extremely backward views on gender, on gays. He wants to, I think he's sufficiently characterized in my previous answer about the generals. He is one of those who wants to, as they put it, de-woke the Department of Defense. But what they really mean is subordinate the military entirely to the personal directives of Trump. Former Congressman Lee Zeldin has been nominated for the Environmental Protection Agency. I think he's a conventional conservative Republican, ran for governor. His purpose is to simply render the agency completely inoperative. They haven't said that they want to shut down the EPA, but that's the purpose. They want to eviscerate any agency that in any way impedes or regulates or restrains the extraction of corporate profit. Same thing with the guy who's the head of the Department of Energy. one thing which is characteristic of the cabinet, which is unusual by American standards, is its wealth. And I'm not just talking about Elon Musk, because that's another order of magnitude. But there are 8 or 9 billionaires besides him and Trump who are taking top positions in the Trump administration. So we have been characterizing this as a government of, by, and for the oligarchy. And I think that's literally the case.
Patrick, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time, and we're going to have to let you go. But before we do, do you have any further thoughts? And how can people follow your work?
Well, I'll answer the second question first so I don't run out of time. I write for the World Socialist website, which is wsws.org. It is the most widely read socialist website on the internet. That's my location. Okay, my final thought is that difficult as the current situation appears, one has to remember that the most powerful social force on the planet is the international working class, that workers produce everything, that the people that we're talking about are all parasites who play no essential function in global economy except to extract personal profit from it. And historically, their class rule has become a complete impediment to the development of society, to the safety of the planet, as we see in the climate crisis, to the health of the population, as we see in the series of pandemics that have come one and now there's another, and of course the overriding threat, and that is the threat of nuclear war. So the question is to make this vast majority of the world's population conscious both of the dangers that they face and of the enormous power which they can exercise if they do so collectively. And that's what we're seeking to do through the World Socialist website.
Excellent.
You take it easy. We're looking forward to having you back. We'll see how things develop.
Yes, thank you so much.
Glad to talk to you guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last month, in a landmark verdict, a jury in a federal court in Virginia found a government contractor liable for its role in the torture of 3 Iraqi men at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison back in 2003-2004, and it ordered the company to pay a total of $42 million in compensatory and punitive damages to the men who brought the lawsuit. The plaintiffs were represented by attorneys from the famed Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, as well as pro bono counsel from Patterson, Belknap, Webb and Tyler, and Akil and Valentine. The private defendant company, acting as a government contractor, was CACI Premier Technology, Inc. The company was found liable for conspiring to torture and commit cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of the Iraqi men, one a middle school principal, one a fruit vendor, and one a journalist. An attorney who filed this landmark case more than 16 years ago is our guest today. She is Catherine Gallagher, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Catherine Gallagher, a very warm welcome and congratulations. A warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me back.
Catherine, let's get a bit of background on the case. And my understanding was it was the first case of its kind to make it to trial. And yet, of course, the whole world, rather early on, it's been some time, learned of the tortures taking place at Abu Ghraib prison, and did it not? In the press release on this victory, the Center for Constitutional Rights, where you work, states, and I quote, "It also brings a new degree of accountability to the shadowy realm of security contractors at a time when employees of private companies, integral to the U.S. war on terror, have often been implicated in human rights abuses across the globe," end of quote. So talk to us about that, but talk to us first as well about the three prevailing plaintiffs and then the importance of this case.
Thank you. The three plaintiffs in this case are truly the heroes of this case for trusting a set of U.S. lawyers for the possibility of justice, for turning to a U.S. court, and for believing that a U.S. judge and a U.S. jury would, I think they thought a lot sooner, but would one day return a measure of justice to them for what happened at Abu Ghraib. So the three men are Suhail, Assad, and Salah al-Ejali. The three of them were picked up in the roundups that were happening across Iraq back in the fall of 2003, and all were detained at the Abu Ghraib prison, which for many of us of a certain generation is equal to torture. It's synonymous with torture. That's where those horrific photos came out in the spring of 2004. So Salah was working as a journalist with Al Jazeera at the time that he was arrested. He was covering an IED explosion and was picked up and sent to Abu Ghraib. Assad was a driver who was picked up and also taken to Abu Ghraib. And Suhail is a longtime educator who was held in Abu Ghraib in U.S. detention for years. While at Abu Ghraib, all three men were subjected to the same kinds of acts of physical and mental torture. They were kept naked for extended periods of time. They were beaten. They were held in contorted positions intended to inflict maximum pain and exhaustion on them. They were subjected to continual mental threats of harm to themselves and to others. And because they were in Abu Ghraib, that infamous two-tier hard site where the photos were taken, they could hear the torture of other detainees, which itself was a form of mental torture. And so over the course of the time that they were there at Abu Ghraib, they were intended to be broken, to be softened up for interrogation. So this torture wasn't gratuitous. It wasn't without a purpose. It was actually intended to break them and all the other Iraqi men, women, and boys who were subjected to such acts, to break them so that they would give so-called actionable intelligence during interrogations. But none of these men knew anything or had done anything wrong. They were all released without charge, which is not to say that anyone should be subjected to torture. But after release, they sought some measure of justice for what they had endured, and that's when they brought this case against CACI, C-A-C-I, the private contractor that was hired to support U.S. interrogation services at Abu Ghraib.
Well, Catherine, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is it was quite a challenge to get this case to court and to trial, wasn't it? The company managed well, to keep it from fruition for, what, 16 years at least. Briefly tell us about the difficulties you had to overcome to finally get their plaintiffs their day in court. And by the way, wasn't the brilliant former head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner, now sadly deceased, originally involved in this case as well?
Yes, let me start with Michael, who is really instrumental to so much of my work at CCR and indeed to this case. As Abu Ghraib, the precursor, of course, was the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and Michael and CCR were very active in trying to forestall that unlawful invasion. And that was a war that was largely about profit, whether through oil or otherwise. And so when the indications came out that there were private military contractors who were implicated in the torture at Abu Ghraib, and that came out through U.S. military reports, investigations done such as by General Taguba and General George Fay, they implicated contractors in the conspiracy to torture and otherwise seriously abuse detainees. So Michael, who had long brought human rights cases under the Alien Tort Statute, along with Peter Weiss and Rhonda Copeland, Michael saw that there was a need to also hold the corporation that profited from torture accountable. So this case, Alshamari v. Kaki, where we just had the verdict, the successful verdict, was actually the third case in a series of cases that we brought, and Michael was involved in the first of these cases. So his spirit and his brilliance, I think, really helped shape our case. But why it took 16 years is that Kaki, the private contractor, really put forward every defense that it could. And while certainly a defendant should be able to pursue viable legal defenses, it really took this to a extreme level, raising again and again and again the same basic theory. And that is that because they were hired by the U.S. government, everything they did really should point back to the United States and the U.S. military, that they were just following orders, if torture could somehow be a lawful order, or that they were fully integrated in with the military, and therefore it should be the military and not Kaki that should be held liable. But the very terms of Kaki's contract with the U.S. military put it as Kaki's responsibility to recruit and to hire and to supervise trained and experienced interrogators at Abu Ghraib. Kaki was paid tens of millions of dollars to hire quote-unquote resident experts, private contractors, yes, but people who were experienced in interrogations. And instead, what was seen is that they had unqualified individuals stepping into the space of Abu Ghraib, a detention center in U.S., a U.S.-run detention center in U.S.-occupied Iraq, and that these unqualified but very influential interrogators stepped into what was a command vacuum and really helped put in place and set the stage for the torture that happened. They gave instructions and encouraged the kind of abuse that Suhail, Saleh, and Assad were subjected to. So that is why Kaki should be and ultimately was held responsible. But they put forward this range of defenses, including the government contractor defense, the political question doctrine, derivative sovereign immunity, many different labels on the same basic theory that because this torture and cruel and inhuman degrading treatment, these clear violations of international and U.S. law happened in a time of occupation while they were working with the U.S. military, that they shouldn't be held accountable. And the law found repeatedly, again and again and again, that indeed they should be held accountable. And that's how we made it to trial. And then based on the facts, the jury ultimately found them guilty, responsible.
Katie, I remember, you know, Law and Disorder is now 20 years old. Michael Ratner was one of the founders of Law and Disorder. And I remember some of our earliest programs going all the way back around this very topic. So I'm so glad you were able to speak about Michael. But let me ask you this. Jim mentioned in his introduction that ultimately the jury in Virginia awarded the three plaintiffs in this case a total of $42 million in damages, compensatory damages, punitive damages. What specific evidence introduced at the trial having to do with your three plaintiffs do you think caused such a large verdict to be awarded?
Yes. So each plaintiff in this case received a verdict of $3 million in compensatory damages and $11 million in punitive damages. And I think what drove that verdict was really a level of disgust and horror by the jury of what they saw and what they heard, both in terms of what our clients were subjected to and also the denial and the deflection throughout the entire trial by CACI of any level of responsibility for sending over unqualified people and then failing to supervise them. The kinds of harm that our plaintiffs suffered, each of them suffers not only from physical injuries at that time and some lingering effects, certainly, of those physical injuries, but even more the mental harm. And I think it's really important for listeners to understand that torture isn't just physical acts. It's also subjecting people to severe mental harm. And we are talking 20 years after the fact. And I can tell you, to a plaintiff, testimony on the one hand was very empowering, and on the other, it was really, really difficult and destabilizing in some to some extent, because what it asked our Suhail and Salah and Asa to do was to go back in time to that moment, those days, those months, where they were subjected to some of the worst treatment of their lives, where they worried every moment about their safety and the safety of their family due to threats that were made. That dehumanization, that stripping of any sense of control over themselves, I think it's extremely important for listeners to understand that torture isn't just physical acts, but it's also severe mental harm. And the kind of treatment that Suhail, Asad, and Salah were subjected to has left a lasting impact on their mental health. And they still suffer feelings of fear, nightmares, the lack of control and agency that they had over their bodies and their safety during those months when they were subjected to torture at Abu Ghraib has never left them. So on the one hand, it was incredibly empowering to finally be able to tell their testimony, their stories, their truth to a U.S. jury. But on the other hand, it was really very difficult. So I think that that is part of what the jury was responding to when they gave $3 million in compensatory damages for each of our plaintiffs, which is what we had asked them to give. And in terms of punitive damages, what we indicated was the cost of the contract to CACI, and that is, again, the number that the jury gave. I think they were trying to send a very clear message to companies, and especially including CACI, that this kind of conduct cannot and will not be tolerated, that it's unlawful.
This is Jim Lafferty along with my co-host Michael Smith. On this edition of Law and Disorder, we're talking with Catherine Gallagher, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who was instrumental in a successful lawsuit against a private and working as a government contractor with respect to torture at Abu Ghraib. Catherine, in the press release announcing the verdict in this case, you are quoted as saying, and I quote, "With today's verdict, private military and security contractors are put on notice that they can be and will be held accountable when they breach the most fundamental international law protections, like the prohibition against torture, and fail to comply with their contractual and regulatory obligations to ensure their employees follow the law," close quote. So to be clear, I'm wondering, do you contend then that there are other companies or individuals still engaged in similar violations of human rights and justice? They're still operating on behalf of the U.S. government?
I think it's a slightly difficult question to ask when framed that way, but overall, where we're at is that there is so much privatization happening right now with functions that used to be carried out by the United States government. And I think that this is something we're going to see even more of with the incoming administration. So whether it's schools, whether it's private prisons, whether it's detention centers at home for migrants and immigrants, or whether it is overseas in places that we don't know, black sites that we don't know about, there are a lot of private companies that are working alongside of, and in some cases even setting the agenda for the United States government. And at this point, what our case sends is a very clear message to those contractors that just because you work with the United States, profiting from doing work that should be in the public service, in the public interest, that you don't have immunity and certainly don't enjoy impunity if you commit intentional violations of international law, such as torture. These are not mere negligence claims. These are serious violations of law, again, both domestic and international law. Torture is prohibited, clearly prohibited and never justified, and there are no exceptions. So if contractors running a detention center for migrants contribute to acts of torture, then they should be and can be held liable. That's what this case showed. So I do think that there is a message that should be heard and heeded, particularly, again, going into an administration where we might be seeing even more outsourcing of what many of us consider government functions.
Katie, Donald Trump's about to be president again within a month. He's on record as being supportive of keeping prisons such as the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay open and filled. He's also said that he supports torture. Is this a concern of the CCR?
Certainly it is, Michael. Certainly it is. And thank you for mentioning Guantanamo. I think for many, it's a forgotten place, and there are still over 30 individuals held there now for decades without charge in many cases, and individuals who've been cleared to be released who have still been held despite being okayed to go rejoin their families or restart their lives elsewhere. So at this moment, frankly, what's most urgent is for the Biden administration in its final month to close Guantanamo, a promise that was made by Barack Obama and a promise that was made again by Joe Biden. So the first step is to close Guantanamo and make sure that that place, that legal black hole, is no longer operational when Donald Trump comes in. That's the first step. But indeed, yes, we will be watching and ready to act when we see serious human rights violations, which could include torture, but I think we're going to see an array of human rights violations in this next administration, as so many groups are targeted at home, whether it's the LGBTQI community, whether it's Palestinian solidarity activists, whether it's those who are championing equal rights regardless of gender, regardless of religion, regardless of racialized identity. So I think we're going to have a lot of work coming, not only for us at CCR, but I think for all of us who believe in equality and dignity for everyone.
Catherine Gallagher, any final thoughts you might want to share with us, please do. And also, before we end, please let our listeners learn more about the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That is to say, how can they learn more? Is there a website they could certainly go to? Talk to us about that, as well as any final thoughts you may have.
Well, first on the case, on El Shamari v. Kaki, while we had a very gratifying victory in November on behalf of our clients, the case is unfortunately not over yet. Kaki has made clear that they will appeal this case up to the Supreme Court if necessary. So already we have been active in post-trial litigation, and we have a hearing coming up on January 10th on Kaki's motion for a new trial and to have the jury's verdict overturned. So we have that, and then we anticipate, if we're successful there, that there will be an appeal to the Fourth Circuit. So at this point, the work continues, but we certainly had a very, very long in coming and very well-deserved victory for our plaintiffs, and a recognition and a validation of all that they endured and of their trust, really, in a U.S. system to provide some justice. So we are gratified for what we've achieved, and we know that the fight goes on. And you can follow this case or any other work of CCR's at www.ccrjustice.org. We have weekly newsletters that we put out, and you can find information on all of our cases on the website.
We certainly appreciate you being with us today to talk about this incredibly important case. We thank you so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me again, and thank you for your continued support of the work of the center and of the plaintiffs and movements that we really have the privilege to represent.
Well, thank you. I just remember Michael Ratner saying, we don't take a case because we think we can win. We take it to expose this government and mobilize people and educate people. But you took this case and you won. Congratulations, and thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
days makes no difference to me, babe. You look exactly the same to me. There ain't no time crossing your legs inside the diner, raising the coffee to your lips, the steam. You saw the masterpiece. She looks a lot like you. Again.